Together we will stand, fight and we'll fall. Come on now, people, let's get on the ball and work together. Come on, let's work together.
Do it, children.
Now, people, say now, together we will stand. Every boy, girl, woman, and man.
This is Neighbors on KUMD. Feature of Tuesdays and Thursdays as we navigate our strange new world. This morning, we're going to talk turkey about chickens, and who better to do that with than Jason Amundson of Locally Laid Egg Company. Hey, Jason, good morning, and thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I'm grateful.
So I understand that there is, like, people are buying a bunch of eggs. Is there a run on eggs these days?
Well, absolutely. And we're seeing that not just in our category of eggs, which is specialty eggs, but we're seeing it basically in all categories. You know, it's kind of the staple. And folks are just home more. They're doing more cooking. They're doing more baking. And, you know, there's certainly been a sharp, sharp increase in demand.
Or are they panic hoarding eggs?
You know, that's really hard. You know, I can see panic hoarding, you know, paper towels or toilet paper. But, you know, with a perishable item like eggs, you know, it just doesn't work as well.
So if you know someone who is working from home all the time, you are within your rights as a human being to expect that they have baked goods that they share with you.
Well, I got to do my part to make sure the cookies taste all right.
I think so, too. I like the way you think. So Locally Laid, as a matter of fact, I heard you interviewed last night in the news, and of course there were a lot of dogs barking, as there usually are, so it was kind of hard to hear. But you indicated that you are selling more eggs now to some of our local suppliers.
Right. Yeah, we've seen, you know, just a dramatic shift in demand. So, for example, a quick story was, you know, early March, I saw the eggs were being basically sold out of Super Ones here in the Twin Ports. And I reached out to our distributor saying, if you want more eggs or if you want to pick up more frequently, let us know. And, you know, Monday crawled by, nothing. Tuesday crawled by, didn't hear anything. And then, boom, it was like 5:28 on Wednesday morning. I checked my email on my phone, and one of the distributors said, we will take every single egg you have. And then it's just been kind of sideways and crazy ever since.
Wow. So some of the small farmers, we're really talking about urban agriculture this
right.
morning.
This morning,
we talked to John Hibbs, and she was giving us some suggestions about folks that may want to put in a vegetable garden for the first time,
mm-hmm.
and they want to try to grow some fruit and vegetables. And so we're kind of talking about that a little bit this morning. So then you guys decided you were going to take the jump to selling pullets to people.
Exactly.
I knew about steers, I knew about heifers, I knew about stoats, didn't know
right.
about pullets until I
right.
read the it's a young chicken.
Yep, it's an adolescent chicken. So, you know, it's very common. You see it at the Fleet Farm stores or L&M or wherever. Folks will buy baby chickens, and you know, they wait 5 months essentially until that bird starts laying eggs. We kind of bypass all that, and we bring in a chicken that's on the verge of laying eggs. So a bird that's about 18 weeks, and in about 20 weeks, you start seeing eggs. So you kind of bypass all that risk, and you bypass all that uncertainty, and you kind of get to where you want to be, which is, you know, taking care of chickens and getting eggs.
Of course, animal welfare folks are concerned always about, you know, the people that buy baby chicks and baby ducklings at Easter time. And then, of course,
mm-hmm.
they grow into adult birds and they don't know what to do with them. And they end up discarded or turned loose or something.
Yep.
I didn't know until I read this information that chickens need vaccinations. So they're kind of like puppies. They need vaccinations.
Yeah, absolutely. That is true. And my suspicion is that the majority of the birds, the baby chicks that are sold, whether it's through the mail or at a Fleet Farm store or whatever it is, you know, they're vaccinated. I think what's different about what we're doing with the pullets is we're going above and beyond by vaccinating for salmonella. That process is a three-part process, and it's time and labor intensive. And oddly enough, it's not required by the law. We only deal in birds that have been vaccinated for salmonella. We don't touch anything that is not. But we think it's an added level of protection for everyone.
Well, that certainly makes good sense. But like any animal you adopt, whether the idea, and I say adopt, acquire, whether the idea is companionship or an animal that will provide you with eggs or wool or milk or fill in the blank, the vet care is definitely something that you need to factor in.
Absolutely.
So I'm thinking about this idea. I'm thinking, okay, chickens need, they're going to need some kind of a shelter. They're going to need things to eat. They're going to need medical care occasionally. You're going to need to keep them. Even your backyard chickens are going to need to be kept safe from predators or wandering into the street. So how do you prepare people for chickens?
Well, I mean, there's just some very, very key things that are, and that are really, really simple. You know, the biggest thing to understand is that a chicken will not overeat. They're not mean in front of, you know, a pie or in front of a candy. I don't have that kind of restraint, but a chicken does. So the chickens basically need access to clean water every day. They need access to food at all times, and they need shelter. And the one thing that I want to emphasize that, and I can't emphasize it enough, is that in our climate, there is a misnomer, there is a misconception that birds need supplemental heat inside their coops. And that is definitively not the case. There have been too many buildings that have burned down. People are putting in heat lamps into chicken coops, and they just should not do that. What the coops do need, however, is they need an insulated coop that's well ventilated, but by all means, it should not have supplemental heat. What you can do on really cold days is purchase scratch, and the scratch is essentially just energy in the form of corn, and dispense that to the chickens, you know, judiciously, and that'll keep them plenty warm.
That is, humans have something like that. It's chocolate and stew, I think. Something that, oatmeal,
cream, yeah.
First thing in the morning. And it's like, oh, I'm warm all over. So if somebody comes to you and if somebody wants to take advantage of this opportunity now to get chickens, would they don't just drive out and put a chicken in their passenger seat. there's a process, and you've got a lot of helping hands along the way to help folks get started with this idea.
Right. So, I mean, I think the biggest thing of what you definitively don't want to do is to say, I'm going to buy a chicken, and then bring the chicken home and scratch your head and go, what should I do with the chicken? So, you know, there is a fair amount of preparation legwork that goes into it in advance. And we're able to be a resource and a guide, because if there's a pitfall, we've stepped into it. You know, we can help walk people through the journey of keeping chickens. And truthfully, it's actually fairly easy. The biggest thing is making sure they have food and water and keeping them safe. And beyond that, the rest is kind of details.
So the idea would be to get information perhaps about the coop, and they could get in touch with you and say, okay, you know, what do I need to bring my chicken home?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we're having we're selling the pullets at our farm in late June, but I think we're also, what's neat is that we're also working with Witta's Feed and Farm, and they're physically going to be on site in late June, the day the birds arrive, and people can go purchase their waters and their feeders and their feed there, or order in advance, and they'll be there when they're there to pick up their bird. And I think the unique thing about keeping chickens, in contrast to putting in a vegetable garden, and is that it is a year-round source of inexpensive protein. And you know exactly where it came from, you know exactly how it was raised, and that is something that is in sharp contrast to other efforts you can put into your backyard homestead.
Now, chickens make, for the most part, a lovely, soft little noise.
Mm-hmm.
And roosters are not legal in Duluth, is that right?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Wouldn't it be nice if, like, morning hosts who already had to get up early could get, like, a special proviso to get a rooster?
Yeah, or put it as a ringtone, as an alarm on your phone, or yeah.
I think that would be excellent, but okay, fine. Now, I have a yard that's mainly fenced, not completely. There are definitely gaps in it, but Can chickens roam through your backyard and eat bugs off the grass? Or maybe if you have your vegetable garden, can they eat the bugs from your vegetable garden? Or
Absolutely.
Do they need to be constrained? And how well do chickens fly anyway?
Great questions. So my experience has been is that there is some level of flight if they get afraid. They can, they can move pretty fast on the ground, but they can actually fly. And every yard, obviously, is different, and every yard is unique. I've had a backyard flock, and it did die. We had a predator come in and kill our birds. It was heartbreaking. I guess the thing I would emphasize most is you will not have any problems with predators if you lock them up at night and let them out in the morning. And make sure that the coop is secure, especially against animals that will burrow. Burrowing animals tend to be the ones that are going to get into your coop and cause the most damage.
Duluth does have a leash law for cats, but of course there are a lot of free-roaming cats, and that is definitely a topic of conversation in certain circles. And I know that there is a free-roaming cat in my neighborhood, and the cat was out yesterday afternoon when I got home. Do you need to be, if you've got cats in your neighborhood that are not leashed as they're supposed to be, are they a concern?
Not that I'm aware of. I have not heard cats being a concern. My experience with chickens is that they're actually pretty assertive, and they will do a pretty good job of defending each other, especially if they've been raised among the same flock. You don't want to get between chickens and, for example, a frog. A frog comes into the fence pen paddock, and that frog is pretty much quickly dispatched. So there's an element of, I call it dinosaur aggression when it comes to chickens. And they will defend themselves. Obviously, there's limitations to that, of course. But I think, as a whole, I wouldn't worry about cats.
If you do have dogs, you have to, obviously, you got to pay attention to your dog with the chickens, because there are dogs, certainly, that come into shelters or that are rehomed because they, you've heard that often enough, they don't get along with the chickens. And so dogs can be a concern.
Then I think that's a very, very legitimate concern. I mean, there's no question that a dog can quickly bring a chicken's life to a very quick and sad end. And I think that's one of those things that every person who takes on the responsibility and the joy of keeping chickens is they're going to make their own best decision. And they know their backyard better than I certainly do. But I think everyone's very cognizant that chickens and dogs sometimes don't mesh well. And that said, at our farm in Renshaw, we have a dog there, and that dog is he's a herding breed. At least half of him is, and he just basically wants to bring the chickens back into the pen all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it just depends on the circumstance, I think.
Partly the breed and partly the animal's constitution, because there are, of course, dogs that if there is something little that is a baby that they could take care of, or that they feel is vulnerable that they can care for, they're just nutty to do it. And
absolutely.
Bless their hearts for that.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you a goofy question. If you are keeping chickens and for some reason it's just not working, time, money, differing circumstances, something happens, can you bring your chicken back?
Well, bring it back to us?
Yes.
No, the short answer is no. And the reason why is that old saying of the pecking order. And that pecking order is extraordinarily true. And there's also some biosecurity issues. We don't want to have a chicken or chickens come into our flock that has not been raised in our flock. Those chickens will be treated very, very, very poorly, even if you put them in at night together. That said, if the bird is young and they're laying eggs, you'd have no problem giving them away to other people who would keep them. So that wouldn't be a concern.
Incredible. What a cool, cool program. What a cool thing. I wish somebody in my neighborhood would get some chickens. I think that would rock. Most
of
my dogs are smaller than chickens, but I don't trust him anyway. Jason, yeah. Thank you so very, very much for taking some time to talk with us this morning. What an interesting and wonderful thing that you folks are doing. Had you ever thought when you got going in your egg business here in town that at some point you would become chicken suppliers to the Northland?
Never. Never in a million years. And we've been so, so grateful for the community support and all the folks in the Twin Ports who helped us out for many, many years. And just a huge shout out and a thank you.
Fantastic. Jason, thanks again so very much. We are looking forward to understand that your wife, the incomparable Lucy Amundsen, is looking at trying to create some Zoom backgrounds with chickens. And I also think that there could be some real potential in inviting chickens to be part of your virtual meeting.
Yes.
With these Zoom meetings.
You could certainly, they're small enough, you could put them on your shoulder.
I like that idea.
Yeah. And,
you know
they have that ability to keep their head steady when their torso moves. So I think that's kind of a remarkable feature. As they stare into the lens, you can move your shoulder or move them around, and the chicken's head will stay kind of glued into that one place.
Wow. I wish we'd talked about this sooner. We're out of time. Oh. Jason, thanks a million for joining us. What a treat. Jason Amundsen this morning of Locally Laid Egg Company, our guest here on Neighbors. It is 10:17, and this is Neighbors on KUMD. Well, just because the university is closed or finishing up its teaching year and doing these things virtually does not mean that our professors are not publishing, are not conducting research, are not working very hard. And for many professors, this pandemic has given them a really unique research opportunity. Dr. Ashley Thompson is an associate professor in psychology here at UMD, and she joins us this morning. Ashley, hi, good morning, and thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So let me ask you a little bit before we talk about this new article that you have out. Is your discipline and the way you work nimble enough that when the pandemic arose, the stay-at-home orders arose, you were able to just pivot and go, wow, I want to study this.
Yes, actually. So I'm very fortunate to be a social psychologist that studies relationships, romantic relationships and sexuality. And the bulk of my work is actually recruiting participants online. Advancements in technology have opened up new avenues where I can recruit participants. So prior to the pandemic, I was already recruiting participants from social media sites. And this, people are still virtual, in fact, more so. So I've actually seen a bit of an explosion in my research.
Oh, that is fantastic. This is so interesting. Romance in the social distance, romance in the time of COVID-19. Tell me how people maintain romantic relationships if they've got a sweetheart that they've maybe been cooped up with for 6 weeks.
Yeah. It's obviously it varies from person to person, but when talking to experts, particularly clinical psychologists who work with couples, with relationships, you tend to see two different trajectories. So you see these couples who are really great at navigating and, you know, adjusting and modifying their techniques in this pandemic to fit what works with them. And then you're seeing this other trajectory of people who struggle with change, who struggle to modify their relationships in these times. And we're seeing potentially a decline in relationship satisfaction for those folks. So it kind of seems like the stay-at-home orders and this pandemic are having one of two impacts on relationships, a positive one or a negative one. It seems like there's not a lot of gray area. So you're seeing some couples come out much stronger and some couples who are really fighting to try to keep things working.
Are you finding that you can look at other areas of somebody's life? I mean, if you know, for example, that your friend hates change and is just really kind of rigid, can you kind of make assumptions about what's going on in their relationship?
Kind, perhaps, I don't want to say that, you know, it applies to everybody, but as a psychologist, we call this tolerance for ambiguity. So we think about this as a construct. We think about this as a trait people have, and that people can score high or low on tolerance for ambiguity. And these are people who score high on it are people who can adjust, right? These are people who aren't afraid of change, who are really good at modifying and adapting. And then the people on the low end are those who score low would be those who really struggle with unpredictability or with change. And so if you have friends that you know more or less how they would likely score on this concept of tolerance of ambiguity, you probably have a fairly accurate idea of how their relationship is functioning right now.
It's one thing to say, oh, we're going, you know, through this tough time while we're trying to hear about a job. But you can say, well, it'll be done in a month. We'll know about the job in a month. But this particular kind of ambiguity where we don't know how long the stay-at-home orders are going to last and we don't know how long it will take us to get back to quote-unquote normal or what that's going to look like, is this even more stressful for people? And is that reflected in their coupledness?
Yes, absolutely. I'm so glad you brought that up, because some of the research that looks at long-distance relationships, for example, have shown that folks in long-distance relationships who are already relying on virtual methods, this idea of missing somebody can enhance a relationship, and particularly for those who have this tolerance for ambiguity, but to a point, right? So for long-distance relationships, having an end in sight can be good. Take that and apply it to the situation we're in now, where we might not be long-distance, some might be, but even being with a couple now, we still need that end in sight. So these folks who really struggle with this tolerance for ambiguity, it's heightened, it's exacerbated by we have no idea how long this is going to last. Even if things do lighten up, are they going to go back? If there's another wind of, of diagnoses. So the tolerance for ambiguity, it has a huge impact on relationships, and it seems to be exacerbated by the fact that we just have no idea what's happening.
As you talk with your study participants, are you finding that people are maybe at odds with each other because, oh my God, he's underfoot constantly, or she is just around all the time? Or are they reacting more in terms of their hardwiring?
That one I sort of struggle to comment on, but so I typically work with virtual. One of my research interests is how people are navigating their relationships virtually. I work with different online matchmaking sites to see how people are navigating. But in terms of relationships where people are in a house together, the stuff that I've read and things I'm hearing from my colleagues is that we're seeing this enhance what they call relational turbulence. So I'm not quite so sure if it's related to hardwiring as much as just we're seeing really high levels of turbulence in these relationships. And one of my friends told me, it's now where you might have had times apart for work, but now you're clashing because your routines are clashing. You might realize just how sloppy they are in the workday in terms of doing dishes that you might not have seen before. And so this is definitely something that's a byproduct of the times we're living in. And it's creating more turbulence for all sorts of couples, but particularly for those who are already on that track I mentioned about that struggling or this relationship distress track.
Well, and I mean, how are you expected to function in a healthy manner when they insist on loading the dishwasher wrong?
Or putting the toilet paper on the wrong way.
Exactly. I mean, so these are the sorts of things that people are grappling with. What about folks who do not have partners? First of all, the idea of online dating now is just, it seems so utterly counterintuitive. But what do I know? I mean, really, this is not my wheelhouse. So are people finding that, well, everybody's got all this extra time, this is a great time to date, or what?
This is more my wheelhouse. This is the stuff I'm really interested in, is how technology, before this pandemic, how technology was impacting our romantic relationships and dating and sexuality. But now is this really fun time to see, okay, online dating used to be, we meet people, it's used to facilitate real life dating. But now we don't have that in-person dating. So how are we using these online matchmaking platforms and these online dating sites. And the big trend that we're seeing is that people are spending a heck of a lot more time using virtual chatting mechanisms. And some people argue that this is actually great and it's making progress in the way that people online date. So prior to this pandemic, you'd put up Photoshopped pictures of yourself on your profile, and you might do some, you know, snarky small talk before you ever met up face-to-face. But this pandemic is forcing people to really get to know each other before they ever meet face-to-face. They're forced to have meaningful conversations, and they're forced to see each other virtually, maybe without the Photoshopped elements of their selfies. So some people argue that the way online dating is going is actually benefiting from this pandemic.
That's an interesting, that is definitely an interesting idea. It is something that you do see evolve over time. You see people using it differently. You see the kinds of people that you meet differently. And of course, generational experiences play into this a lot. What about folks that are living alone and, you know, may or may not be kind of looking around and going, why is everybody getting in such a tizzy about this? This is how I live my life every day.
There are those people who I've heard anecdotally, they're like, hey, I've been prepping for quarantine my whole life. There's those folks who classify themselves as introverts who, you know, this pandemic lends itself really well to their lifestyle. And typically those folks weren't real keen on dating in the real world anyway, or that they weren't about dating multiple people. So they seem to have adjusted fairly well. But it doesn't mean, as humans, we're social beings. And so even if you already lived a lifestyle that was conducive to social distancing, you still need to find ways to connect people or connect with people. And that's where this technology is proving incredibly useful, whether it's Zooming or FaceTiming or even just texting. It's even if you were already introverted, these little technological advances have proven incredibly useful.
How do you see, as we wrap up here, first of all, how does it work for people maybe who are not technically savvy or they don't have access to a lot of the technology? And then how do you see perhaps some of these things moving forward into our post-pandemic life, whatever that may look like?
Yeah, so to answer your first question about those who may not be technologically savvy or competent, it's tough. It's tough, especially when we're being, our government and you know, different scholars and researchers in this area are encouraging us to adopt technology to try to keep the social closeness. And so if that's something that is difficult for people to do, if they feel uncomfortable using technology, it can have disastrous outcomes for folks. Because like I said earlier, we're social beings and we rely very heavily on our interaction with others. And so it's tough. I have to admit, it's going to be tough for people who don't feel comfortable with technology, who aren't already living with somebody or who have close connections with somebody else. With respect to the changing landscape, I see, particularly with respect to online dating, I see this having a pretty big impact. People are talking about how the way we approach relationships and dating might actually change in the long term because of this, in favor of, like I mentioned earlier, forming these relationships before we ever go out on a first date. And so because people are perhaps learning about the benefits of forming a relationship prior to becoming intimate or sexually intimate, perhaps we'll see this change the landscape of dating for the better, where people get to know each other before they jump into any sexual intimacy or sexual behaviors.
Well, it is a fascinating topic. I wish we had more time, Ashley, but thank you so very much for taking some time for us this morning. Lots to ponder and lots for folks to think about their own hardwiring perhaps a little bit, or maybe how they can reach out and stay socially or romantically connected. Thank you so very much for joining us again, Ashley. What a treat.
Thank you for having me. It was a blast.
Dr. Ashley Thompson is a social psychologist here at UMD, and she joined us this morning as our guest on Neighbors.